Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 272. How do you deploy your Python application without getting locked into an expensive cloud-based service? This week on the show, Michael Kennedy from the Talk Python Podcast returns to discuss his new book, Talk Python in Production. Michael runs multiple Python applications online, including a training site, blog, and two podcasts. While searching for the best solution to host his business, he documented what he learned into a book. We talk about containerizing Python applications, generating static sites, preparing for traffic spikes, and avoiding cloud service lock-in. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Well, I'm very happy to welcome back Michael Kennedy to the show. I'm glad you could make it out in war-torn Portland as it is.
Christopher, thank you for having me back. You know, it's all right out here. It's all these crazy things you see on the news. It's like, yeah. If you leave the 5-block area where that's happening, then
yeah.
It's like, it's not like that.
Yeah, totally. It's such a beautiful town. We looked at moving there when I was moving from Hawaii. Partly because of all the gluten-free options, which are amazing there.
Yeah, the food scene's bigger.
Well, you're back after 5 years, so that's fantastic. And congratulations on 10 years of Talk Python, I guess.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, Talk Python has been around for 10, going on 11 years. And
yeah.
Also, congratulations to you. We've both been going a long time. And
yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
When I started, there had been other Python podcasts, and they all stopped
yeah.
after a while. And, you know, there's not many, even today, there's not very many. And so it's a big deal to keep going and keep working on this stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Congrats to you as well.
Yeah. I don't know if you edit it yourself. I'm still doing that, which people think I'm crazy, but I do enjoy it. And so,
you know, I do have an editor.
Yeah.
He's an amazing guy. He does really good work. But I find sometimes that it's better, like, if I'm in the moment, just to, like, go through it and just sort of capture the ideas and the inspiration that have been flowing. So, yes and no.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're here to talk about a book. Is this the first book you've ever written?
Let's say yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I published a book, co-authored a book with Matt Harrison.
Oh, okay.
I kind of did most of the background work, and yeah. he did most of the book writing work on it.
Okay.
Yeah, and that was on PyCharm, and it's good, but I don't feel like it counted for me as a book, because, like, I did sort of the foundation, but I didn't sit down and write the book as much. So this is the first solo book that I've ever done, and yeah.
So it's titled Talk Python in Production, and then I'll give the subtitle because I think it's good, A Cloud Agnostic Guide to Building, Scaling, and Managing Your Own Python Infrastructure. And it's, officially released October 3rd, 2025 here?
Officially released, and, you know, it's a little bit like App Store-like. I think it came out on Amazon on the 4th or 5th after they approved the book.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Sure. Yeah, totally.
They didn't make me add in-app purchasing to the book like Apple did for my apps, but, you know, it's okay.
Yeah, yeah. That's so funny. I remember that battle you were going through. You've done a couple of interesting things with it. One, I just want to talk about the book generally a little bit. I feel like it reads like a blog, and I do not mean that at all in a derogatory way. You include links to lots of other resources and blog posts by other people that, like, explore topics more deeply. And a couple questions there, like, why did you choose to do that? And then the other question is, do you think a typical, quote-unquote, publisher would be against that practice?
You know, I think they might be just a little bit.
Yeah.
I think they want to have a lot of control over it, you know?
Yeah.
And to me, I was hoping to capture the zeitgeist, like, you know, the the feeling in the air that other people are also going through. And that was a lot of the motivation of the book is like, I see a lot of people struggling getting their Python apps out.
Yeah.
Or I see people struggling with overly complex, overly expensive setups that are probably amazing, but probably not suited for their context. One of the most important lessons in programming, I think, that people can take is context is crucially important for what you're doing, right?
Sure.
Hey, Christopher, you should have unit tests. Oh, is this a little utility you're going to run one time and it's going to transform data over and you're going to throw it away and never run it again because now you got the new data?
Yeah.
You probably shouldn't have unit tests. You run it until it works and then you're happy. You know what I mean? Like there's, because your unit tests are generally for like long-term and as things change, you want to make sure it keeps working, right?
Right.
And I feel like in the deployment side and the cloud side, we have that gets a little bit opaque and people don't see it as well because people love to talk about, oh, now we've leveled up. Now we're doing this next thing and look how amazing. Now we're bringing in this service too and look how cool that is. Plus, on top of it, you have financial incentives that are not necessarily aligned, let's say. Yeah.
I just watched Cory Doctorow's one of the many times he's talked about inshittification, if you will.
Yeah.
That'll probably be the first time I've cursed on the show, but whatever. It's a word.
Yeah, it's an amazing.
Yeah.
It's an amazing concept. I like Cory Doctorow. I like that concept.
But it's true with hosting entirely. Yeah, like just is. Like this idea of like, well, who are the customers and where are they sort of pushing you toward? And then you're sort of locked into it. And so I like this idea of sort of, again, sort of carving out your own piece of the internet in that sense.
I'm a huge fan of autonomy. I would take a different job if, you know, not, it doesn't apply to me necessarily because I have my own company. but if I was working at a company, I would take a different job that paid less, that gave me more autonomy with my time, that gave me more autonomy with the technology that I choose, that I get to program with, and so on. Even if it paid less, you know, maybe not extremely less, but like to a significant degree, I feel like this autonomy is... it's really important, but also it keeps you inspired.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, oh, I get to do exactly what I want to do. And when you sort of carve out your little own piece of the cloud, you can look across the entire open source world and go, all of these things are possible. I can bring in any of these pieces that I want.
Right. You're not locked into other people's solutions in that sense. It involves a learning curve and some potential pitfalls, but hopefully there'll be resources for you. But yeah, it's nice to not be whatever K letter of a service is offered by AWS at this point. You know?
Yeah, I just walked into AWS. I mean, gosh, it must be over 200 services there. It's a significant number. So, you know, and we were talking about incentives. Right. There's a bunch of really big companies that have truly complicated scenarios that need solving. And those companies pay the hosting companies millions and hundreds of million dollars potentially.
Yeah.
And then when you show up with your $20 a month,
right.
You know, like that's sort of the, like, okay, we're going to kind of lean towards the 100 million people because it's better.
We're going to really design the features for them.
I mean, I know they consider everyone, but at the same time, there's just natural drift that occurs, right? And I don't know, there's just something wonderful about that's all? It's that simple? That simple. And it's just like a couple of things beyond running my app in development. And you're good to go. You know what I mean?
And that's what's really kind of cool is that it is more than a book on DevOps and setting up a Python project in a sense and putting it out on the web. It's also this journey that you've been on, this sort of postmortem that you get to see all of your background. And it's not you specifically looking at a fictitious example. It's like, this is your business. You also give, you know, an example project for people to play with, and maybe we'll discuss that further as you go. But the idea that, you know, no, this is what I'm doing and these are the choices I made and why I made them, which I really appreciate in the book.
Yeah, thank you. I really like to give these looks inside what I'm doing or what I can find out that other people are doing if I have that visibility, because that's what I wanted to see when I was getting started. I didn't want just something in the abstract. I wanted to see like, yeah, no, these are the four things that we actually, these are the four apps how we build them. This is the web server we use, and here are the settings that make it way better than if you just got it out of the box, for example, right? Those kind of things. Yeah. Are like, oh, okay, I can just copy that and I'll just mimic that, but that's not for me, but this part is, let's go.
Right. You can kind of choose from the menu. Yeah.
Yeah, a buffet, a deployment buffet.
Yeah. But I was really intrigued that you were like, you know, linking out to like Hynek's blog and you're linking out to just a whole mix of people, you know, across the board in there. Was that, I don't know, does it just kind of make sense to you, or is that kind of in your style?
It is. And also a lot of the stuff that I link to, like talking with Hynek, he helped a lot. There's a couple of people that gave me feedback on blog posts or little samples that I posted along the way and said, you say it's good, it's 80% good. If you put this little bit of, you know, sprinkle this thing on there, it's all the way good. Like,
oh, okay.
That's amazing. You know what I mean?
That's cool. So they're kind of contributors in a way.
Yeah, in a way.
Which is nice to be able to give them a credit, which is usually just like it would just be in the back of the book normally, but here you're actually giving it in the body of like, well, actually this is where this concept kind of came up. And
right, exactly, right.
Kind of a continue the conversation.
Yeah, and he's also a really great writer. So happy to link to the stuff that he writes, you know.
Yeah, yeah. One other feature you added that I found really intriguing, and I didn't know about it until I, you know, actually dug into the first chunk of the book, is you have these audio reader briefs. You want to describe them and why you included yes. them?
Let's say they're quirky. I really like them. They're not for everybody, but I really like them.
Sure.
They're not at all required. They're just an extra. So I tried to do a bunch of extra stuff for the book. And one of them was these audio reader briefs. I thought, hey, I'm okay with audio. I have a expensive mic in something like a studio. I could literally do an audio book version of this. No problem. Except...
who wants to listen to you read code?
Even the code, it might be kind of okay if you sort it, but when you get to the 40 lines of Nginx config, holy moly, I just don't think it's practical. Yeah. So I'm like, well, I want kind of people that have like this audio aspect, like you and I were both like really into audio as well. And so what can I do? And so I thought, what if I could give you the equivalent of, I didn't say it because it's copyrighted, but Cliff Notes in audio form, kind of, for the chapter, right? So I actually came up with, if I take each chapter and I sort of structure the text in the right way, and then I create a research project with Notebook LM, and I get it to create a, you know, Notebook LM is incredible. I can create like a little multi-person podcast conversation thing. I'm like, all right, create a...
It's so funny because it includes all the ums and...
I know, it's...
You knows you, and
I know,
stuff like that.
And they interrupt each other, right? Yeah. They like jump over each other. Oh, and they get weird. I know.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of... It's cute and it's fun. And so each chapter includes like a 4-minute or so little riff by these two quote hosts from Notebook LM.
Notebook LM, yeah.
Talking about what's in there. And they get it... Not 100% right, but pretty right. So I thought, you know what?
Yeah, yeah. The acronyms you said, you got to watch out for.
you can tell it how to pronounce stuff, but sometimes it ignores you. Sometimes it gets it right. You know. Sometimes it'll pay attention to what you say.
Yeah.
But those are in there so that people can just, I think it's 1 hour and 20 minutes. And if you want to just listen to it after you read the book or listen to it as like kind of a refresher, or you want to listen to it before each chapter, maybe it kind of just puts you in the mindset, because it's a wandering sort of flowing conversation around the ideas, and then the book is like more structured, you know what I mean? So yeah, I threw those in there.
That's cool.
Yeah. I also put a code gallery, something that that goes at the end. So I wrote my own custom book building publishing thing that takes Markdown to this book thing.
Nice. And sounds like you were building lots of tech across this.
It was fun. Yeah, it was really fun. And so it would go through and say, anytime I have a code listing, you know, like a triple, like a code fence, triple block markdown piece, it will pull it out. It'll figure out what chapter it's in and what subheading it is. It'll put that as a little, like a listing one and this chapter listing two.
Nice.
So if you want to find the code, you just, chapter three, here's all the code. You don't have to hunt through the text. You know what I mean? Same thing for the links used. There's a section, same things for the pictures, like those kinds of things I tried to add, because once you're writing your own code, and there's a whole chapter on like, maybe you should build it yourself. once you're kind of in there, you're like, oh, it's like 20 lines of code and a few regular expressions and we're good to go here.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a tough time on the show generally deciding how really deep I want to get into DevOps, because as we've already kind of discussed a little bit, it's not always a great fit for the audience. You know, like the audience is here to learn about Python and Python projects, and DevOps is so specific. And it's, I feel like it's often a smaller team within an organization that sort of handles it. It's not necessarily quote unquote an IT department, but it's kind of off to the side often. And yes, they use Python all the time. And so I always kind of wonder about that. Is that something you struggle with on your show too sometimes?
Oh, 100%. 100%. Yeah. I think if you get into the true, you know, infrastructures, code at scale and all that kind of stuff,
yeah,
then I think it gets pretty specialized, right? Like the people running, like, yeah, we create a whole bunch of VMs doing this, and then we just push this button, and then it automatically, right? I had Matthew Rocklin and Nat Tabri from Coiled IO on, and during the podcast, Matthew Rocklin spun up 1,000 machine cluster in EC2.
Wow. Yeah.
And then he said, well, what if it was ARM? I asked, well, what if it was ARM? He said, all right, well, let's shut this one down. We'll fire up the ARM. We'll do it again, but with ARM settings. And we fired up 1,000 ARM machines in the data center.
Wow.
And those are amazing. Like, I was, whoa, okay. Very cool, Matt. Very cool. But
that's not going to be a fit for even your business, right?
That's not what most people do. Like, they're not doing that kind of stuff. And so his service kind of obscures that, like packages that up. So that's kind of right, which is cool.
I think those tools are amazing. It's just, I don't know. It's a hard,
yeah,
interesting to find those points, because it's like, well, how do I even get people in to do this without them burning an entire credit card?
I know. Well, here's all to sort of wrap, come around to the, answer your question directly. Here's what I would say is I think that that kind of DevOps stuff we're talking about now is, other than like, wow, showcase, cool.
Yeah.
Is probably not really germane to most people's day to day. However, almost everyone out there who is a software developer or data scientist has a thing or an idea,
yeah, they
and like
share
a little
it.
Side thing. And they're like, I want to get this out. How do I go from zero to like, it's available, not it's, you know, running Netflix sort of thing.
And I agree. And that's kind of why I keep dabbling and talking about these topics. And it's like, kind of like, where do I find that balance? That's why I really like the book. I'm also intrigued that you started with Python Anywhere, which is kind of weird. I did not know that was the history of Talk Python.
Well, because I tried to answer that question for myself. And when I started, I'd only been doing Python for a year or two.
Okay.
So I didn't know anything. And I mostly was a Windows developer before that. So I built like desktop apps, which was fun, but it doesn't teach you anything about deploying web apps on Linux.
Yeah, the web, I mean, you're kind of there. I don't know. You can maybe talk about it a little bit, but like the idea of creating your own services and tools and those kinds of things on the web, definitely you were deeper in those trenches. I find you to be like an expert at the web stuff. I would definitely, you know, reach out to you if I had questions about web deployment. And there's definitely areas of the book that go deep and hard into those areas, which is really interesting too. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. I talked about web frameworks and what I don't think we have a great name for them, but I'm calling them production app servers.
Okay.
Which maybe like leans a little more from the enterprisey side, but we have all these different web servers. You know, if you run Flask, it'll say, don't use this thing in production. Get a real production web server. Mm. But a real production web server is like kind of the back end thing for another web server that is actually the front end that does that. So, you know, like there's a lot going on. And so the thing that runs your Python code, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff going on there with like, we've got Unicorn, Uvicorns kind of come out on its own a little more. Hypercorn, you've got Granion, which is a new fun one. Which is what
And that's one you definitely have embraced in this case. Those are things that there's a sort of, again, very non-Python, but if you're going to, you know, go down this road, you're going to have to be touching some of these things. And they're not necessarily, like, I haven't finished the book. I haven't played with all the examples, but I remember seeing more of this conversation maybe 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Of like standing these things up. And then I feel like maybe the conversation changed a little bit and it kind of became a little different. So I'm intrigued to see your approach here. And maybe we just talk about like what I covered your blog post about. Is it stack specific? What was the term that you used?
Stack native is the term, yes. I'm trying to. Right. It's a riff on cloud native.
Right.
Which you'll hear people saying, we're building a cloud native application. And that just makes me go, you know, like sort of sucking my breath. Like, oh. Because it's both got potential for being awesome, but you know that it's going to have like big time lock-in.
Right.
And for better or worse, right? So when someone says they're building cloud native, they're like, okay, I'm going to look at the menu, the buffet of things that the AWS console or the Azure console of 150, 200 services offers me. And any part of my application, if I see like, oh, we need login, we're going to bring in this service. Oh, we need stateless stuff. So we're going to bring in this whole part over here becomes all serverless over here. And then those hook back in. And just it, to me, it just feels like that might be great, but you know, it's, are you designing for something you actually need?
Right.
Or are you designing for the dream? Yeah.
Yeah. The scaling thing is always kind of like, wow, like how much infrastructure, if you're building a social network, that's one thing. If you're building a tool, or in your case, a hosting platform for video content and podcasts and so forth, like there's a boundary potentially that you're going to scale from. And maybe you could just describe, you know, what the current stack is. I know it gets a little complex here, but, and we'll provide links to a lot of the stuff to people can check out a little bit more in writing.
Yeah, I'd love to. So at its heart, I have quite a few web apps running. I've got little APIs, and I'm not a big fan of microservices, but there's also just, I need a thing. Like, I'll give you an example before I get into the stack. It's like,
sure.
I wrote a course, recorded a video course, published it for people, and it was using some kind of open weather platform that had a free tier for its API. And so the course was teaching how to consume API. So, hey, let's put a little weather app. That'll be fun. And you can just point it at this thing. Like, okay, everybody, just get your API key here, and then here's how you write the code. Well, guess what? The free tier is gone.
Yeah.
And now the class is broken. I'm like, oh, great. So I got to either stop what I'm doing, go re-record a thing that was perfectly fine until it changed again.
Right.
So there's a few things like that. There's probably like 5 or 6 classes that have things like that. So I'm like, you know what? Not again. I'm going to build an API, and that API is going to call the API I would have told them to call.
Right.
When they call my API.
But it's over here and I control it.
Yes. And it's
not going to disappear.
And, and if that thing changes, I'll find a replacement, or I'll put static fake data, or what, I will just find a way to make it go so that the students don't have a bad time.
Right.
And it's predictable. So there's like some of those little things that are just, I've got to have a place for them, right?
Yeah.
And so the current stack is, I ended up getting like one big server. So I have an 8 CPU, 16 gig RAM machine running as a VM.
Okay.
Just Linux, just SSH into it. And on there, it's running a core database server that doesn't share databases, but shares the database server, kind of like a managed database. Like a lot of these places have, hey, we're going to have a managed database. So you can go over there. But in my world, I have a database.
Okay.
And my app can either use one of the existing databases, or it wants to create a new one. It'll just create a new one as if it was managed. But instead of being managed by them, I just have it running and I back it up frequently at my place, right?
Okay.
So I've got a database, MongoDB, but it could be Postgres. And then I've got an app for Python Bytes, an app for Talk Python, an app for the courses. and a whole bunch of other things that we can talk about. But
yeah,
in there, I have a mix of Flask in the form of Quart, which is the async, the truly async version of Flask.
That's
right?
One of the first like real world examples. I'm like, oh, hey, this is actually using Quart. That's great.
Yeah. And I find Quart to be totally stable. Quart was created by PJ Jones. I'm sorry. But then it's been brought into the Palette organization, the same group run by David Lord.
So it was like an outgrowth that was like a almost like a bit of a fork to make it an asynchronous version of Flask.
Yes. Yeah. And now it's become kind of an official project of Flask,
nice.
Even though it's technically just the word Quart instead of Flask. Like you could almost just do a find replace Quart and Flask and they're interchangeable.
That's great. That, yeah.
Which is cool. It's just the Quart one runs a little faster, a little more async, let's say.
Yeah.
So we got that and Pyramid and just I have them all running there on that one server, but instead of running them just all together, which is possible, but not ideal because you want some isolation and you want to be able to bring other things in there. And so I put all those behind Docker.
I was going to ask you a lot. We're going to probably dive into Docker a little deeper here. Yeah, that's good.
Docker's something I always kind of put my head in the sand, like, I don't need that kind of stuff. But really at its heart, Docker is just some isolation that you can run.
And reproducibility.
And the reproducibility is glorious. That's right.
Yeah.
And that's the big thing is the reproducibility. And then most of the commands that go in the Docker file to set them up is what you have to type in Linux anyway on your VM. If you're going to say, well, I'm not doing Docker, well, you're typing the same commands. You've taken away the word run.
Yeah. You just sort of separated it or contained it or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. So I have all that stuff managed with Docker Compose instead of something more complex like Kubernetes or some other EKS or something, right? Because to me, I'm always trying like bias towards simplicity and like keeping stuff straightforward. So I can easily go over there and look at the logs, or I can shell into the Docker environment, right? So it's like Docker compose exec, the name of the thing, like ZSH or bash. And then it's as if you're logged into that machine, right?
Yeah, and just using shell commands to look at everything inside of it.
Right. You kind of have to like shell twice, once with SSH and once with Docker compose, then effectively you're like in the terminal of that thing. And so to me, that's something I really wanted to keep is the feel of like, I just have an app run here. Here are the logs. Here's the code. I can even tweak the config in production if I absolutely had, you know what I mean? Like, I don't do that. But you want to be able to sometimes like, why is that not looking? Let me log in and do a LS and see what it sees. Oh, the file's not there from its perspective. Like, you know what I mean? There's just like this abstraction that you want to get away from.
Does it help that it's divided up that way in the sense that they're not quote unquote microservices? I mean, they're kind of their own thing. But if you have a problem, I have a problem. I know it's about this particular project that somebody's like maybe sent a ticket or sent you a comment or whatever. You can say, okay, I want to go look at the courses area.
Yeah.
And look at that. Does it help that it is in its own container?
Yeah, I think so. I think it does.
It's kind of like a directory structure of sorts then.
Yeah. I mean, it's already its own web app. And so in that sense, it's somewhat contained, but you can kind of restart the container, redeploy the container.
Okay.
Without messing with the other stuff so much, right. You know?
Yeah, you focus on downtime quite a bit, which I'm sure was like probably a complaint that somebody would look at your solution and say, oh, yeah, but this could happen or that could happen or this, whatever.
Right. We don't have triple replication on this thing or that thing.
Right. Yeah.
How important is this stuff for you, right? So I think the advice in the book and the advice that we're kind of riffing on here applies to small teams of handfuls of people, you know, five to 10 people. If you have a DevOps engineer or if you have a sales representative for you at AWS, it's probably beyond, although I've had sales calls with the AWS people as well. And no thanks. But you know, I mean, if you have a dedicated sales rep that's like takes you to lunch, you don't, it's, you're probably beyond
it.
This might not be for you, but here's the thing. I think, it is for like 90% of the people
right
out there. They don't need like that great of a scale and that great a complexity. So what I really like about the how I'm running my infrastructure is I got one big Linux server running in the cloud. I SSH into it. From that point on, it could be in my closet. It could be in some other data center. It could be wherever. I just do whatever I want. I've just got world-class power, cooling, networking, failover, all that kind of stuff for the machine. But then you get a pick, right? So then you get a pick.
You get to pick who's going to host the machine for you.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's the whole thing about cloud that's so funny is it's like, it's still somebody's machine.
Exactly.
As they found out in Korea recently, unfortunately.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah. 7 years of work loss. That's really, really rough.
Oh gosh, yeah.
So I think it's really interesting to be able to just take that and simplify down and go, it doesn't have to be that complex. Like this setup can handle an insane amount of traffic. I think the load testing I did for the courses with not much caching, I don't do hardly any caching there. It's like pure database calls. I think you can do 30 million data-driven requests a month or so for like $50.
And where are you at?
Right now, it's...
As far as the percentage of that.
It's way under. It's way under that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's still a lot. Actually, the podcast gets quite a bit of traffic. I think I'd say probably around 9 million data-driven requests a month across all the apps.
As a podcast note, just it surprises me, but it also is really cool that people go to the beginning of the podcast and start from there.
Get them all.
Isn't that crazy? It's awesome, and it's really cool, and it's a testament to like both of our work in the sense that it's evergreen in a way. Like a lot of the concepts are worth going back and digging into. So I'm sure there's a lot of that traffic is from that, just the whole back catalog.
To be honest, I would say a lot of it is also, podcast clients are a little bit like a distributed denial of service, right? Because they're all like...
They have to refresh themselves.
You got a new one? Not all of them. Like Spotify, there's one thing that asks and then it shares it out to the Spotify group.
Yeah, yeah.
And Overcast, there's one Overcast thing that... ask, is there an update? And if there is, then it'll share it out. But other ones are just like, update? Is there an update? Is there an update? Really? Like a kid.
So there's some that are a little more pestering you.
They put the checking for update into the client instead of the server. Whoever subscribes to you, every one of them is checking for an update. You know what I mean?
Wow.
Like every hour or something.
Not efficient, but...
No. But it's easier for them, right? Like whoever wrote that doesn't need to run a service that checks all the podcasts.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things I wanted to dive into a little bit about the Docker thing, generally, it sounds like that's a recent development for you.
Yeah. And I resisted it because I'm like, I don't need this. It's, it's not that big of a scale. And then I started playing with it. I'm like, yeah, this really lets me not worry about the isolation in other ways. So instead of having like, well, I need a small web server to handle the courses traffic and I need a small web server to handle the podcast traffic, that's also overhead if you were looking for that sort of... So for example, if I got to restart the podcast one, I'm not messing with the courses and so on. And that turned out to be not the way.
Okay.
It was just way more complicated. So then I put them all together into one big machine that costs about the same but has way more capacity.
Yeah, yeah.
And
the 8 CPUs and the amount of gigabytes of RAM.
And what's really interesting about that is, and I think this applies to the cloud native story as well, that I think people don't really connect with, that I think this is a very important lesson. Let's suppose I have 8 small servers.
Okay.
Each with 1 CPU and 2 gigs of RAM. Or I have 1 big machine with 8 CPUs and 16 gigs of RAM. I have the same CPUs, I have the same RAM.
Yeah.
But here's the deal. If you're running multiple apps, if you're running a single app, it doesn't really matter. But if you're running more than one, like podcast plus courses or whatever, they don't have the same needs for compute at the same time almost ever.
Okay.
Right? So on Black Friday, the courses traffic goes crazy.
Right.
The podcast traffic...
You've done a promotion and,
exactly. And you send out as many emails as people are willing to receive from you because that's the world we have to live in.
Right.
Then that's driving a crazy amount of traffic.
Yeah, yeah.
To the courses bit. But the podcast bit, you know, you probably haven't released a podcast exactly the same time you're sending all these emails. So when the training site, the courses site peaks, if it were all distributed across these little like serverless bits or other things, it gets the peak of whatever's allocated to that little thing. If you combine them and then isolate them with Docker, they can peak to the top of the machine.
As a virtual machine, they can use the resources that are available right. of the 8 CPUs.
Right. It's got 8 CPUs, not one. And it can spike all 8 of those as long as they're not being consumed by the other apps, which are probably chill and doing like part of one CPU level work.
Right. Okay.
Right. And so these abilities to spike and like say, oh, this one really has to use more RAM and it has to like really hit a bunch of CPUs. It can kind of burst mode it. You know what I mean?
Right.
Long as all your apps are not pinned all the time, combining them gives them higher ceilings for what they need.
Yeah. It's like a shared whatever.
Right. Right. But when you fan it out
workout
to like,
room, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's like you can use all the equipment. If you fan it out across, say, a bunch of containers at like some cloud container service, and they guarantee to give you one CPU and 1 gig of RAM per container, you don't get the same. And so,
no, you don't. Yeah,
There's this really interesting advantage.
It's a premature limitation that it's kind of cool. You get this overall, whatever threshold or whatever you want to call it, ceiling that any of them can have at some point. And who knows what that will be. You know, occasionally you said it's it's the podcast, and occasionally it's the courses. And
right, exactly. You think about, and it also is the database server. If the database server, right, it also has the ability, like if there's some huge database like analytics thing going on, it can grab all the compute as well in these little bursty modes. Neat. So when you think about like, oh, you put on one server, so you can't really scale it because, you know, we're not in like some kind of serverless thing where more requests come and they all fan out and so on. There is a component of more scale for the same amount of compute when you just kind of go like, I'm just going to get a Linux machine and it's going to be in the cloud somewhere and I don't care where it is. Let's just go and write apps for it. Yeah.
It's time to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. It's all about concurrency in Python. Concurrency is the act of having your computer do multiple things at the same time. And with Python, there's several paths you can take. The course is titled Speed Up Python with Concurrency. And it's based on an article by previous guest Jim Anderson. And in the course, my frequent co-host Christopher Trudeau takes you through how I/O-bound programs are affected by latency. What are concurrent programming patterns and where might you use them? What are the differences between Python concurrency libraries? And how to write code that uses the threading, async I/O, and multiprocessing libraries? If you've heard lots of talk about async I/O, but are curious about how it compares to the other concurrency methods, or are wondering what concurrency is and how it might speed up your programs, I think this course will be a good investment of your time. RealPython video courses are broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, give you code examples for the techniques shown. All RealPython courses have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. This kind of leads to your phrase that you're... or a concept that's in there of minimal cloud lock-in, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think if you're integrated with EKS, DynamoDB, EC2 automation, just on and on and on, right? You pick 20 services out
the Azure versions of those things and so forth.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. Same story for Azure. There's no difference. You're pretty much staying. You know what I mean? Like you can change, but it's like, I know I wrote an app for Mac. I'm going to rewrite it and shut it down there. And I'm going to rewrite it for Windows. It's going to be over there now. Right? You can do that, but it's not easy. But all of these different places offer good, here's a Linux VM for you, infrastructure as a service, like OG cloud sort of stuff. Right. And
it does feel retro in a way.
It's retro and it's not retro all at the same time. And it's amazing, right? No, it's like the Docker Compose stuff is amazing. So I have a script that you run that can take a Docker Compose configuration and turn it into a systemd daemon. Right. So like all those sites and stuff come up in a, like the right order. And it's just, if I reboot the machine, they just come back because I have a script that says create a systemd daemon that like restarts the Docker compose thing, whatever that happens to be, on boot.
Okay.
And the Docker compose takes it from there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. In this process of getting deeper into Docker and sort of building the containers, were you using other tools? Like in the book, you mentioned OrbStack, which I've heard a few people use. What was that exploration process like and what tools worked for you?
There's a handful of tools. OrbStack is really nice. You know,
it replaces what?
It replaces Docker Desktop.
Okay.
And so you need in development some way to like test out your Docker. You can, but you probably shouldn't just push your container to the cloud.
Should try it locally.
you should get it working locally and then try it.
Yeah, yeah.
I just push to Git and then it rebuilds the container on the machine and off it goes. Now, but when I was building it, I was checking out. And one of the things that's super cool about OrbStack is it gives you tons of visibility and accessibility into it. So I can go to a running container and it has a little finder icon. So I click that and now I just have a finder open inside of the container and I can just navigate around. And
yeah, this is going to be quicker than SSHing in and doing the stuff we're talking about.
And you get a GUI if you want, right? Like I can drag that thing and drop it on cursor and then ask AI, like, what's wrong inside of my container? You know what I mean? Like, that is not the easiest thing you would normally do.
Right.
But it would be like trivial with OrbStack.
Okay.
Right. And it's got a click a button for a terminal, click a button to look at the logs. And some of those things you can do with just Docker compose logs or, you know, Docker exec bash. Right. But I don't know. It's not a huge change, but it's just polish. You know what I mean? It just makes it feel a little bit nicer, I think.
Yeah, I've heard of a handful of these tools and I kind of wondered about them, like what are some of the advantages? But that makes a lot of sense what you're saying there. Because normally Docker Desktop is pretty similar. It's all very terminal based. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. You know, another tool that I'm not using, but I know some folks who are using it to good effect, that is a little bit of an alternative view, a little bit more of like a Heroku style.
Okay.
Is Coolify, Coolify.
Okay.
I think is it. And let me just double check for it.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, Coolify.io. Self-hosting with superpowers. And so it's an alternative to Vercel, Heroku, Netlify, Railway, etc. And you do the same thing. You set up one machine and you install Coolify on it. But instead of actually managing the Docker files directly in the Docker Compose setup, you just ask it to create new apps and you get pushed to it, sort of like you do Heroku. But it lives in exactly the same story, right? You could run a database server there. You could run multiple apps there and so on.
The thing with like something like Heroku that I feel like is a selling point is the idea that you can almost point it at a Git repository. And then when you make your commits, is that Coolify doing something kind of similar?
I think it works the same way. I think so.
Yeah.
But to be clear, I don't run it, so I'm not 100% sure. But I'm pretty sure.
That's okay. Yeah, but I think that's one of those things that, again, people are looking for solutions depending on the size of the thing that they're trying to set up. That is kind of a nice way to kind of approach it too. Potentially.
Yeah. So I've talked to some folks using Coolify who have team members who need to like push stuff out to deployment, but they shouldn't really have access to the server, nor should they need to understand really what they're doing with the server. They should with their app, but not with the server.
They don't have the DevOps badge yet.
Yeah, exactly. even if it's not a gold-plated, like serious one, it's like a little...
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, more like a DevOps patch.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But yeah, so it gives like a different way to sort of deploy, but it also has the same philosophy, which is really interesting, right? Like I set up a machine, I carve it off for myself, I can install stuff, and it has little push buttons, install other self-hosted things that I might need, right?
Yeah.
Click here to add a Postgres server. Click here to add, Umami Analytics.
Yeah, yeah.
Or Uptime Monitoring. And then it runs. So that's what I have as well. Actually, I looked right before we got on the call, so I know the current number. I have 27 different apps and database servers running on my machine right now.
Yeah, and some of them are very specific, right? The like you said, the analytics tool that you're using, and you have a couple other kind of monitoring tools that kind of look at everything else. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Like if you want some kind of uptime status page, right? You could go buy a service like Pingdom or whatever, or there's a bunch of open source self-hosted ones. And I think this is actually a bit of an undersold side of this as well, is when you build apps that run in production for your business or for a serious project, you usually want to bring in not just your code, but other stuff, right? Like I want uptime monitoring. I want analytics. I want, you know, notifications if this happens, or you know, one of my apps is like a Discord bot that then talks to Discord for the TalkPython Discord that I'm working on right now, right? So that's one of the things. And once you kind of get this rolling, it's like, oh, all I got to do is throw one more Docker Compose thing up there,
right?
Link it in the script, and now it's managed by exactly the same story that it was before. And I don't have to buy new services, set up new serverless things, and all these different things. You know, I just like, it's just
expanding another little piece inside the virtual machine.
Yeah. You just click it into there, and you could do that with Docker Compose. You could do it with Coolify or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it's really neat. If people look at the self-hosted world, like search for awesome self-hosted, the problem is not what will I include or how will I run it. The problem is holding yourself back. You're like, oh, I could have this, and I could have this, and oh, we could have this too. And you're like, no. Each one of those, you're going to at least have to back up the database. You know what I mean? You still sort of got to do something, but it's just so cool. Like,
right.
The analytics system.
It's like plugins and other platforms. Like, you know, I'm a music guy, and it's like, yeah. And it's like, oh, I could have these billions of plugins and, you know, easy to go crazy.
Yeah. Or a code example is if you've got like 28, or maybe that's probably even way too small, like 208 VS Code or PyCharm extensions or plugins.
Yeah, yeah. You're like, what is talking to me right now?
Who put this squiggly here? There's like at least 10 things that could have done it. I need help.
Yeah.
So if you're prone to that, you got to like really show some restraint. But it's very cool because like I turned off Google Analytics years ago because I found so many developers were running ad blockers that it was blocking it, right? And then there's a whole GDPR thing and cookie banners, right? You got to put a cookie banner like, hey, did you know we're reselling all your data? The EU made us like show you this thing that tells us we're reselling your data. Great. Okay. I just wanted you out of my way.
Yeah.
I think the cookie side of thing was mishandled.
Not elegant at all.
All right. I'll give you a rant, Christopher. I'll give you a rant. So
okay.
I think what Europe said, which is okay, I think. They said, we don't want people reselling our data and taking it and doing things that we don't approve of it.
Right.
Fine. I'm on board with that. So what we're going to do is make them announce it if they do and publish it at the bottom of their website.
And you have to know this. Yeah.
Yes. And it will embarrass them so much that they will stop. And that is not what happened. They said, well, this is a hassle.
We hate our users so much.
Exactly. They're just like, yeah, we'll tell you how we're stealing your data. I mean, you could have looked at the terms of service, but we'll give you the dumb pop-up if you have to.
Yeah, it's bad.
What they should have done is they should have said, users are permitted to use technology that blocks you from using tracking cookies, and you cannot restrict their services if you do. Like, how many sites do you go and says, turn off your ad blocker?
Yeah.
Like, if they said, you can't have that, you're good.
I can't believe that publishing sites do this. Like, you know, the actual like, oh, I'm supposed to read your article and like I got served this and I go there and I can't even read it. And it's like, well, now I know that I should have like some other term for it, you know, like the whatever, you know, red sites. I do not want to go here ever, you know, the red list versus a black list or a white list.
Yeah, like, I was a big fan of Kaggy, the search engine. And Kaggy, when it shows search results, has a little like ranking of like how tracking it is. Yeah, it has like a little red warning if it's like overly doing on that.
Yeah.
Not in the blocking, but on the tracking. Anyway, so
yeah,
all of those are reasons to not use things like Google Analytics, because at a minimum, you got to put up one of these cookie banners. And I don't know if you've noticed, there's no cookie banners on TalkPython. That's not because I hate the GDPR and these other bits of legislation. It's because we don't have third-party cookies.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because I said, hey, I'm just going to get some self-hosted analytics software, run it on the same domain, so it's first party, it's not third party.
It's not invasive.
It's not invasive. It's not sharing it with anyone.
Yeah.
It's... And so once you go and realize that there's this insane world of thousands of open source apps that are exact, like they all have a Docker Compose file that is ready to run and click into this type of infrastructure. It's like, oh yeah, we'll click one of those in and we'll click, click, click.
Right.
Right. I have an alternative to ngrok called Rathole. And it just runs there. Anytime I want to like check out the dev version of my site on my phone, I just type Rathole. It runs a Docker thing. I connect to it. And then I can have my phone working with my thing and even pause and debug it and stuff.
Yeah, cool.
All because it just clicks into this Docker Compose world. And so that's kind of what brought me over to Docker. I'm like, all right, there's a lot of benefit here. Let me just learn it.
I appreciate that the book kind of takes you into that. And again, like I mentioned, the whole kind of blog style where you have offshoots so people can kind of learn a little bit more and dig into these things if they're interested, links out to that stuff. The book really dives into very, very web-specific tech because it has to. And so that may be new to someone there, you know, generally kind of a bit of a non-Python thing if you're not coming from the web dev size. Mm-hmm. And love that it's covered and I think it's really great, but I could see it as a hurdle. And so were there things that you thought about in covering Nginx and Let's Encrypt and CDNs, were there things that you had to think about how I was going to cover this?
The hardest chapter was Nginx, which is the thing web browsers and API clients actually talk to.
Yeah.
Right? They talk to that. It does SSL, a domain, all that kind of stuff. And then internally, it figures out, okay, well, what Docker setup chunk does that actually go to?
It's truly the traffic cop.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's really not a Python thing. And that chapter was hard for me because I wanted to make it practical in the sense that like you could take what was there and use it. And Docker made that a little bit more complicated as well. However, I also wanted it to be useful. I wanted it to be a guide. If people go there, they could take it and they could use it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And you're using that in your example project that people build, right?
Yeah, exactly. I've got this little Flask HTMX video website, and then we just published
how Yahoo used to be.
Exactly. It was like, what if we still had Yahoo and that's how YouTube was built? Like, here's your categories that are just like,
right,
somebody chose this as an interesting page and they put it in the, you know, cars category, whatever.
Yeah. That's a fun nostalgic look.
I love some nostalgia.
Yeah.
So anyway, that gets built out there and it you know, people can play with that and use it and so on.
Yeah. I think that's the tricky part about a lot of stuff is just how can you make it approachable to a Python person? Definitely they're coming from that if they know you and know the audience and know that the project literally is Talk Python's, how is this hosted stuff, which I think is cool. One of the things I wanted to dive into that I feel like throughout it, which is great because I feel this in my bones too. And I think it's kind of this thinking about my audience and having empathy for them in a sense is that you're in this battle that you have faced yourself of complexity versus price. Are there other factors in there or you know, do you want to talk a little bit about like your sort of battle of like, well, how do I get through this and navigate it?
Yeah. I think, two layers. One, I think approach so many problems in programming and sort of extending out to like getting your apps running outside of that is it when you first see it, it looks like a mountain.
Yeah.
But really it's just a bunch of little steps. You know, there's probably it's not one big thing to get your app all up running on Linux when you had no server before. It's probably 50 little tiny steps, each of which is not too bad. Right. But getting down that can be daunting. So I would encourage people, regardless whether they care about the book or not, like as they're trying to like make progress in programming or DevOps or whatever,
chop it up.
See it as little steps that are completely knowable and doable and are not terribly mysterious, even if it feels like one giant overwhelming thing, right?
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to try to communicate, let's say, I tried to communicate in the book. I talk about how much I pay for hosting, right? Like, I think...
I appreciate that because so many people are just not going to. And no, it may date it, but it is your book, so I guess you could update it per se. Yeah,
yeah, actually, like I've updated the EPUB a couple times already based on feedback, so it's really good. But yeah, I don't think it'll date it too harshly, but maybe a little bit. But, you know, the 8 CPU Linux machine, I think it's $50, $56, maybe a little bit less. I think it might be $40. I don't know. It's $40 to $50 a month.
Right.
For all 27 apps, 4 database servers, bunch of APIs, a couple of these self-hosted things clicked. I mean, it's insane.
You think about just buying that physical machine and what your monthly payments would have been if you financed it.
I know. And then even if you went and bought it yourself,
right,
you've got to get it into a data center.
Right. And connect it to the internet. Yeah.
Those colo data centers are expensive business. Yeah. Right.
I had looked at that back in the Apple days when I was deep into FileMaker, which was that was a solution potentially.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I'll buy a Mac Mini and shove it on a server and they'll, you know, watch it for me. But it's just not feasible. So yeah, that price to me is, you know, doable, you know.
So yeah, I think a lot of people get overwhelmed by it. So there's two things. One, the pricing, that is the price. If I go viral somewhere in some way, it's not going to hurt it. It's not going to be more. There's a thing I reference in the book, this app and backend. Well, I think it's sort of a cloud native app. So it's an app that was built on serverless technology that scales and stuff from Vercel. So this thing called Kara, C-A-R-A, this woman, I think in South Korea, built it because she was an artist and she wanted to offer a view of art that was not AI based. Like what you do is you give it some bunch of images or something and it'll filter out the AI ones and only leave you the human pictures. I don't know how it did it. I'm sure it was computational.
Yeah.
Because then she got a $96,000 cloud bill in like a week or two. Because, hey, guess what? It went to the top of the app store. Sorry. You're done. You know what I mean? And so that is not okay. That's company destroying level of not okay to get a $96,000 cloud bill when you thought it was going to be a side project.
Right.
And you're
as an artist who's maybe not making that much.
You're already frustrated that AI's undercut your business, right?
Yeah.
And now you get this bill. You're like, holy smokes.
Yeah.
So I do think price matters. And I think it's really neat to say, it's $50. I do have a CDN and it costs some money because like the podcast ships tremendous amounts of data and the courses or videos and so on. But you know, that's not a huge portion of it. And you're not going to get a $96,000 cloud bill without choosing to get a $96,000 cloud bill, right? Like it's that said, and the reason I put that at the beginning is the point of the book is not about the cost.
Yeah.
The point of the book is how does one or a handful, you know, a couple of people confidently run sites that have low downtime, that have super high speed, super low response time. Like if I go to the TalkPython site and I pull up the web log, it's response 6 milliseconds, response 9 milliseconds,
right.
Response, oh, this one's long, 47 milliseconds. Oh, that's a slow page. We'll look at that one later. You know what I mean? Like that, how do you do that without a huge array of complexity and services and then caching. And then whenever you have caching, then you have cache invalidation and staleness. And like, it just explodes. Like, oh, okay, we could get this fixed with caching, but now we have another harder architectural problem to solve. You know what I mean? And like, how do you just do it in a simple way? So the core idea of the book is like, how do you get professional-like stuff with low complexity? It just so happens that it also comes with really low costs, which is awesome. And flat costs, not scalable costs. You know, every request makes it worse sort of costs.
Yeah. One of the things that you focus on as far as the websites that are involved in your project is making them into static sites.
Mm.
And I like to just there's always that jargon that we get into here. And often I feel like, well, what does that even mean? And how does that change the performance, which I kind of relates to the thing I think you just mentioned. So maybe you could just describe it for us.
Sure.
Yeah. What does it mean for a website to be static? And
it means, I mean, that's the bullseye, if you can get it right. So here's the thing. Most websites have some kind of logic that generates the page. Often that's Python code running, or it could be JavaScript node or whatever running. And then it talks to a database. The database is doing a bunch of queries. With that, you have got the possibility for the database being slow, for the code to be slow,
right,
for the database to be down, for the code to crash. Like, there's just a lot going on, right?
So somebody goes to a blog and they go to the page that says, show me all the recent posts, or show me all the posts.
Right. Or clicks on, like, show me the ones tagged with DevOps.
Okay.
And that might run a query where category equal or category equal DevOps, right?
Yeah.
And that could be a standard site. A static site is one where it's literally just HTML files and image files and static files. And so when you click something, it just says, and here's the, all it has to deliver to you is the pre-saved HTML tags that are on the disk. Right. And then what's cool about that is then that can be distributed over a CDN to hundreds of points of presence POPs throughout the world. So when you click it and you're in South Africa, it goes just down the street to the point of presence in South Africa in Johannesburg, and then like just ships it over. And like, even if your site didn't exist, once the CDN is sort of seeing the things, you might be able to delete it and nobody would notice for a little while, sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
It's really, really easy. It's so easy to make it fast and so on. The problem is not everything is static, right? If you go to Gmail, it's got to look at who you are and pull that kind of stuff up.
Right.
Or, you know, if you go to Real Python and you pull up the courses, well, what courses do you have access to? What courses have you taken? What is your progress versus just a random thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Right?
You could make those static, but you can't have an interactive thing.
What changed for today?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like, even you could rebuild it, but you couldn't say, pick up where you left off, right? That kind of stuff. And so most apps can't be a static site. And so there's this debate of static site, good. Data-driven site, also good, but way more complex to run in production. And so one of the things I talked about in the book is like, well, could you build static sites? There's like Pelican and other interesting Python libraries, but a really, really good one is something called Hugo. This is not a Python thing, it's a Go thing, but it doesn't matter. It's just a tool that you run against your HTML against your markdown that then turns into a static site. And all you push out is the result of that transformation, right? So what I wanted to cover in the book was, one, talk about static sites a little bit, but two, usually this is are we going to build a static site or does it have to be data driven? And usually there's something that just like knocks it over and like, now it's data driven. Now we're down the path of like running like infrastructure, not hosting files. So one of the ideas I want to propose that it's super easy to do with this setup is, well, what if some part of your site was fully static, built from Markdown in an incredibly simple way, but other parts weren't, right? So for example, right. At Talk Python, if you go to the blog, that whole blog section is written by Markdown. It's built by Hugo. It's 100% static, can be served over CDNs like crazy.
So you're building these paths that are paved.
Yeah, but it's talkpython.fm/blog, right? Yeah. Not blog.talkpython, but it's the website, and some subset of it is a static site, and the rest of it is data-driven with Mongo and Qort, right?
Right.
So it shows you how to set up Nginx so that even though those are completely unrelated projects, when I go to the blog or I go to the podcast bit, I'm touching totally different things on my dev environment that don't even seem like they connect. But when you publish them to the infrastructure, they get interwoven. And then actually the Python app looks at the sitemap of the blog and says, well, because this is /blog inside of me, when I build a sitemap so that things like search engines and AI search and so on look around my site, I'll like pull that in and integrate it into the sitemap. So it feels 100% like one whole.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas that allows you to, I feel like there's a lot of times people are like, it's this or it's that. You know, it's either or. And
yeah,
it doesn't have to be either or. It's like this part of the, this, these 100 pages would be best this way. And this data-driven thing over here is going to be that way. But from a user perspective, you don't go like, oh, now I'm in the static site. You know what I mean? It looks the same.
Right.
I mean, the web design's a little bit different because it's the blog view. But, you know, it doesn't look from a URL or deployment structure that these are two things.
It makes it much more enjoyable for somebody to use the site because it's speedy and so forth. Mm. But when they do need to do, you know, a search across things or look for different areas of it, it kind of just makes sense. It feels, you know,
yeah,
a part of each other, but you can just, I don't know, everybody appreciates a quick site, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird how often now that there are people that are just like, whatever, and they'll just, you know, you have these load times, you're like, is this site dead?
Yeah, I know. It's really, really, really bad. And all I can think is that whoever built this doesn't know about database indexes, or they didn't pay attention to them here, because there's no way this is running as an optimized query. And it's taken 10 seconds and it's not that much data. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
But yeah, you can even do cool stuff like with Hugo. You can use something called Page Find. I don't think I have this in the Talk Python blog, but I have it on mine, which is also Hugo based. And what it will do is it will pre-generate a bunch of JavaScript, like a binary tree of JavaScript search results. And then as you type, it goes boom, it just auto-completes and it downloads whatever, just the little pieces that it has to traverse in the B-tree. It's like nearly instantaneous. So it has a super fast, super nice search engine. But guess what? It's still a static site, right? So talk a bit about those kinds of things as well.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, we could keep going on forever. You have been experimenting so much in the world of, say, sort of AI and AI tools and even agentic stuff. And I'd love to have you come back and talk more about that stuff at some time. You have to let me know.
I would love to talk AI stuff with you, and I would love to come back and do it.
Yeah.
If you ask me now,
yeah,
we may go deep. It might be a two and a half hour episode.
Yeah.
I let me just say, I've been a AI coding helper skeptic for a long time. I feel like the super autocomplete type stuff that you get, and like, hey, I'll just write this. If you hit tab, I'll write this function for you. It's been really, really just in the way and bad. But the new agentic stuff it's game changing. So we can talk about that sometime, but.
Yeah, yeah. I'd like to.
We don't have time. Yeah, thanks.
No, it's good. Because I've been kind of resistant myself, partly because I think I'm stuck in the hype cycle part of it and kind of trying to pay attention to what's happening. And so, but yeah, I definitely would like to dive deeper. And that sounds like a good repeat.
I was resistant to it as well. I was right there with you. And then I was hanging out with a friend of mine. He happened to have his laptop. We were having a beer at this bar. And he's like, man, I got to show you something. Let me just pull it up. And within an hour, we built just the most amazing app. And
that's cool. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm like, this is okay. I need to pay attention. This is unbelievable. This would have taken a week, and we did it paying attention over beer in an hour.
That's great. Yeah.
But can I say one more thing really quick?
Sure.
People have asked, because we live in a crazy time, Christopher.
Yeah.
I mean, it is really weird. Like, how much of this book was written by AI? Like, oh, it must be written by AI because everyone's cynical and stuff. And like, no, actually, like, zero AI. It's all humans. Actually, I have a made by humans little sticker.
Yeah, I saw the little logo. Is that something that is open source that we can share to put on other things?
I'm happy to let people share. I just got, I'm a fan of the Noun Project. And I think people have said, like, you're made by humans, pictures AI. I'm like, no, dude, I did that in Pixel Maker. There are pictures that are made by AI. But that one is not one of them. Okay.
Yeah.
So I just got a little Noun Project, like, human looking thing and stuck it into a square or something. But yeah, well, I'm happy to share it. But I do think it's weird.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about the audio portion, which, you know, there's a disclaimer there. And I think that's fine too.
Yeah, exactly.
I could see that getting leveled. Yeah.
Yeah. So people are like, yeah, okay, first question, how much of this AI? Be honest. I'm like, all right, none of it. Really? None of it, other than maybe a picture or two, but not the text. Anyway, I really appreciate you having me on here. I just want to say to people listening, there's a whole spectrum of how complex your app has to be. Don't let looking down the road at, you know, some big complex cloud sort of story feel like you can't get what you want out in the world, out into there. It can be simpler, can be cheaper, can be easier than a lot of people are telling you.
Yeah, I think your project will get people looking at those components and those tools, and they don't have to break the bank to get in there and start playing with it, which is great.
Yeah.
Which is a refrain that I think has almost disappeared with the disappearance of VC money backing these services to have free tiers and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, if you're spending $10 a month or something like that to experiment in this world, I don't think it's that bad to get in and play. So that's great.
Yeah, I agree. If it's something you really care about, you put a bunch of time into it, $10 or $5 a month is probably okay.
And it's such a thing of showing your work, you know, like what you're building and creating. So cool. Well, I have these questions I like to ask everybody. So the first one is, and these might have changed from 5 years ago, what are you excited about that's happening in the world of Python right now?
Well, we just avoided going down there. I'm really excited by the agentic AI stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
There are so many projects and things that were just, they were like a constant nag or something that I'm like, that is not great, but it's kind of a big project and it's going to just take way too much time for me to go down. Like, I'll give you two real quick examples. I had a blog on WordPress. I wrote a blog post about it. I had a blog on WordPress. And then I restarted blogging over on Hugo because I found I could write in Markdown and I own Simple World rather than logging into the WordPress CMS. And it just...
And you could add it to your TalkPython?
Yeah, I could add to the TalkPython stuff. I could just... It just felt like where I wanted to be. And I just didn't want to write on WordPress anymore. But I had my own custom domain over there.
Yeah.
And every year I would get a $48 bill. It says you got to keep paying to have your custom domain and your website over here. I'm like, but I haven't written on it in like 10 years.
Yeah.
I don't want to ever write on it again, but there's 160 articles there and I didn't want them to go away, but it was really hard to migrate. I'm like, I should really just take the time to like migrate this and like write some code that'll like move it over. And it would have been weeks to get it all just right, you know?
Yeah.
And so one night I'm sitting outside in the summer here, chilling out back, and just, I bet Cursor could do it. I bet Claude Sonnet and Cursor could do it. So I just told it, like, here's the website. Gave it really good instructions, said, I need you to convert this and integrate it over here into my Hugo site. Hour and a half later, done.
Wow.
You know, yeah. There's a really good joke that I saw that had a, like, two buttons, a button A, button B, and there's a person sweating trying to decide which one to press.
Right, right.
The one on the left said, pay $12 again. The one on the right said, admit the dream is over, you know, for a DNS registration.
Yeah, right? Totally.
Like, your domain of your app you've never launched, but you got the domain name.
Yeah.
Are you going to renew it? Or are you going to? And I felt kind of like that. Admit you're just deleting all that work or pay the $48. And then within an hour and a half.
That's cool. Yeah.
Done. Gone. Integrated in the new search engine. All this, like, beautiful. The images, everything copied over.
That's nice.
And one more real quick one was TalkPython was originally written in Bootstrap 3.
Oh, okay.
Which, if you go to the Bootstrap 3 site, it says, move away from this. This is deprecated. There's a security problem. Like, go away. Don't do this. But
stop it.
But 8,000 lines of template code, 8,000 lines of CSS. I'm like, I can't do that. I cannot justify the time it'll take to completely rewrite that much web design. Mm. But then through agentic AI,
I figured out a couple hours later translate all that stuff. The CSS is one of those things like, man, there's experts for that too, right?
Exactly. It rewrote all of it. It restructured all the HTML. I mean,
oh, cool.
I think it was like 6,000 or 7,000 lines of code change and just a few hours now. So these projects that are just like, oh gosh, that drives me crazy. I wish I could.
You've been sitting aside. Yeah.
And it just, I can't justify the time and energy. I can just turn these things loose on. It is such an exciting time and people should really see it.
I had a really good one recently. I own a lot of music equipment. I guess that would probably be obvious if anybody's seen any of my video stuff. I have been stuck. I don't really enjoy writing music through my computer, partly because I get distracted and I'll worry about optimizing the setup and so forth. But I found a tool that I like a lot. It's a looping tool that runs on the iPad.
Yeah.
And I actually have been pulling things, probably if you've watched one video to another, I'm actually setting up in a different space and I'm creating in there, but I've a billion loops I've been collecting over the years, like literally decades of loops and so forth. And I had this great collection of them and the CD itself, unfortunately, formatted them in a way where it was just the file name and no extension. And I know that it's a WAV file and it's like directory upon directory. And I was like, mm-hmm. oh, this is so dumb. I know I could write up a little program and do it. Whatever. Let's just do the AI thing once. Let's just do it right now. And so I did this a couple months ago. I went into Claude and I just said, okay. And I one-shotted a prompt to just have it like, okay, go in. I want you to make a CLI for me. I want to be able to specify what the extension is going to be. I need it to go recursively through the directories and so uh-huh. forth. It popped out the code. It worked on my first attempt. And I was like, that's beautiful. Wow. Yeah, yeah, that's really yeah. cool. So now I have access to all these WAV files instead of me going in and like command C, command V,
yeah,
and renaming the files manually or whatever. And, you know, I mean, I know that's part of coding, but like I have done the hard manual thing before when I'm just, you know, in a hurry, if you will, but it was really nice. And again, now it's a tool, and kind of like Simon Willison likes to talk about, he builds all these things and his GitHub, you know, repository is just filled with all these tools that I don't have to rewrite that thing again. You know, now I have this thing, I could kind of come back to it. And I mean, we can definitely go down that whole rabbit hole of like, well, all these green field things are fantastic. You know, what does it mean for things that are existing and, you know, that sort of structure?
All right. Yeah. I'll give you a primer. I think, first of all, your example is amazing.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of thing that anybody can try.
Yeah.
It will make a big difference to you and it is zero risk.
Yeah.
Right? You're not like, oh, it's going to, what if it gets it wrong and it's going to break our site? Like,
yeah.
You would have done it by hand. You probably would have made a mistake at some point anyway by hand. And so here you are. You know what I mean? It's amazing.
Yeah.
I think I will put this out there. I think it does better in existing code bases than it does in green code bases.
That'll be our conversation.
That's going to be where we're going. Yes. And I have right. tens of examples. Large-scale examples. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll have to schedule that. All right. So this one doesn't have to be about programming, but I think it might be. What do you want to learn next?
What do I want to learn next? Wow. Okay. I want to get better at motorcycle mechanics.
That's cool.
I'm not bad at it now, but I've been riding motorcycles since I was 10. I raced motocross instead of played football when I was in high school, things like that.
Sure.
And when I was...
So you've been repairing them all along?
Yeah, sort of exactly. Somewhat? Well, yeah. And when I was in early high school, my brother and I would be like, oh, it's time to rebuild the engine in the motorcycle. Let's go down and like take it apart and we'll just rebuild. We'll put a new piston in it. 45 minutes later, we're back to riding. I mean,
oh, cool.
It was amazing. As like high school kids, you can't do that now. It's like saying, I want to be a car mechanic, and you dream of working on a 65 Mustang inline six where you can reach around and you just, oh, we'll just change the spark plug. And
there's actually space in the under the hood where you can reach around and get the things.
And now they're not all locked away. And they're not behind like electronics. So
right,
the same thing has happened to motorcycle. It's super hard to
I can imagine
kind of work on them. So I would like to sort of refresh that experience. That's what I want to learn.
Awesome. So the last one is, what's the best way that people can follow your work online? I think some of it may be obvious, but...
Some of it may be obvious. Yeah. A couple things. They can subscribe to the podcast at talkpython.fm. That one is pretty good for keeping up with me. And maybe follow my personal blog over at mkennedy.codes, okay. which is my Hugo site.
Is that the WordPress moved over?
It's got the Hugo. And then if you look at any post, instead of /post/name, it has /post/r/name. That's one that came from WordPress because that's the archive.
Okay.
So anyway, people will know that way. Yeah. So they can go over there. Also, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this real quick, is something I found incredibly valuable these days, like last year or two, is actually going to the GitHub feed of just what people are doing and seeing. I started following a bunch of people on GitHub and I'm finding just tons of cool libraries and projects by just going.
So you've built a collection of people that you follow, and it's sort of like news, if you will, of like what is happening with these developers.
Yeah. And anytime they fork something or they star it or they post, you know, they'll close an issue, but also do a release, or most significantly, is they've starred something they've discovered. I'm like, oh, that is interesting. Let me go look.
Yeah, yeah. That's very cool.
More than to follow me, I want to encourage people to follow people on GitHub. It's actually a really cool way to sort of just let a cool stream of new projects flow by.
So then when you just go to your quote-unquote GitHub homepage, you see that with all the updates.
Yeah, I've got... yeah, I've got pages and pages of stuff now that go by that's cool, that from people that I know. And like, I know who the people are. I'm like, oh, I see. This person starred that. And I kind of know what their vibe is. So I see what's going on. This is cool. Let me follow that.
That's cool. Yeah. I didn't know that the star activity was part of following. That's great to know. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, yeah. So
awesome. And then you're on some of the socials, I think. So I'll include some links there. I think you're on Blue Sky and Mastodon and so forth. So
yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. Well, Michael, it's fantastic to catch up with you.
Yeah, you as well. It's been a great conversation. Thank you, Chris, for having me on.
I want to thank Michael Kennedy for coming back on the show this week. And I want to thank you for listening to the Real Python Podcast. Make sure that you click that follow button in your podcast player. And if you see a subscribe button somewhere, remember that the Real Python Podcast is free. If you like the show, please leave us a review. You can find show notes with links to all the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.